Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hi, everybody. My name is Angie, and I'm an alcoholic. Now listen. If you have not had a drink of alcohol and remembered who you woke up next to, you ought to make some noise in this damn room. Make some noise up in here. Hell yeah. First of all, I want to thank the committee for asking me to come and for calling me and asking me to do this. I love sobriety. I really, truly do. And you know what? These speakers have been off the hook, haven't they? Woo! And I'm going to tell you something. The buck stops here for Angie. I ain't got nowhere else to go. I don't want anywhere else to go. Alcoholics Anonymous and the God of my understanding has been good to me. And I need to tell you that you'll hear in my story that I got reasons to be happy. And I got reasons to be joyous. And I got reasons to be free. This program has done so much. If you're new in the room, man, keep coming back no matter what. No matter what you think, no matter what they think. Just keep coming back. I'm from Greenville, South Carolina, and back home we lived in, thank you very much, we lived in a little white house on a red clay road, and we got our water out of wells, and we drank buttermilk and ate cornbread on a regular basis. I had flaming red hair and freckles, and nobody else in my family did. And one day my brother had me hemmed up out at the outhouse, and he said, "I know why you look the way you do." He said, "Because the mailman is your daddy." So whenever I saw the mailman coming down the road, I say, "Daddy!" And I run up to him, and he'd put his arms around me and pat me on my head and tell me how cute I was. And thank God, you guys are so funny. This woman's up here like, oh, that's so sweet. And he put his arms around me and tell me how cute I was. And thank God for the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and sponsorship. And I found out in my step work that turned out to be a little pattern for me, actually. That if you just put your arms around me and tell me how cute I was, we were basically married at that point. And, you know, 6 months down the road, I'm asking you what your last name is. So I'm from a family of Baptist ministers, and my family had my lot in life planned out for me. I was to be a famous gospel singer and take care of my whole entire family. And I remember when my father pulled me to the side and he said, "Look, baby girl, you know, you got some gifts, and I'm going to need you to use them so that we don't have to work anymore." And I remember I got on my big wheel and I started riding down the road, and I remember being stressed at a very young age, and the responsibilities and the pressure was just huge. And so my father got transferred from Greenville, South Carolina to Cincinnati, Ohio. And he moved up there, and he was traveling back and forth trying to find a place for us to live. And in the process of traveling back and forth, he found himself a little girlfriend, and he moved with her and moved us up to Cincinnati. And that left my mother to raise my brother, my sister, and myself. And you'll hear me talk a lot, ladies, about my mother, because when I got sober, I sat in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and I assassinated my mother's character on a regular basis based on what I perceived my past to have been. And thank God for the steps and the traditions and sponsorship, because my perception has most certainly changed about my mother. My mother may not have been somebody who put her arms around me and told me that she loved me on a regular basis, but what you've taught me in Alcoholics Anonymous is that love is an action word. And when I look at my mother's actions, She worked in a restaurant and she sent all three of her children to private schools. She didn't tell me that she loved me much, but looking back on it, her actions clearly proved that she loved me. And so we go into this Catholic school now. So now I got a big red afro, a white blouse, a plaid skirt, black and white Spaldens, and I got beat up on a regular basis because it just did not look normal. I knew I didn't look normal, and you knew I didn't look normal. This girl named Squeaky. Squeaky was like 6'10 in the fifth grade. And her and her little posse used to beat up all the kids that were different. And I was different. And one day, her and her posse stoned me all the way home. And I ran in the house and I told my mother, I said, "Whew, I'm glad I made it in the house. She was about to kill me." And whenever my mother sounded like this, I knew she meant business. She said, "You know, Angela, at some point you got to learn how to stand up for yourself. So you go right back out that door and you stand up to her. Or you stay in here and you get the butt whooping that I'm going to give you." And I knew what my mother's felt like, and I only knew what Squeaky's appeared to be. So I went out to the parking lot and I walked up to Squeaky and I said, "My mother said I'm supposed to fight." Well, it didn't sound like that. It sounded more like this. "My mother said I'm supposed to fight you." And she said, "Come on then." So I balled up my fist. And I closed my eyes as tight as I could. And in my mind, I said, "She tall, so I gotta reach up." And when my brother and his friends used to act like they were boxing, he'd always have two fingers up. So now I'm standing in front of this Amazon like this. And I thought to myself, "I'm gonna catch her off guard." And I reached up. I got her right here. It was like the happiest day of my life, man. I had hit the... Look at this woman up here applauding violence. "Where are you from?" "No, not to come to your neighborhood." So I got her right here. It was the happiest... Oh, my... I couldn't believe it. I hit the giant. Now, when I hit her, though, she didn't budge. She just looked at me, and I said, "You getting ready to kill me, ain't you?" And she gave me the big beat down. But I got this thing called alcoholism that helps me remember what I should forget and forget what I should remember. And what I remembered was that I hit her. What I forgot was that she beat the life out of me. Story of my life. Story of my life. So my mother comes to this Catholic school that we're going to, and she had got a better job working for a company called Avon, and she came and got us, and we lived in the ghetto when we first got to Cincinnati. We lived in the projects, and my mother came and got us and took us to our home. And we moved into this neighborhood. It was an all-white neighborhood. We were the first African-American family to move into this neighborhood. And so from the age of like 13 to 20, I wasn't even black no more. I listened to Bob Seger and the Silver Bullet Band. My favorite girl group was Heart. And the first concert I ever went to was Led Zeppelin, baby, 1979. I remember one time I was at the Ted Nugent Foreigner concert, right? Foreigner was singing "Feels Like the First Time." I looked around that Coliseum, it was 60,000 white people and me. I said, "I am bad." And that night I became a legend in my own mind. And so I hung out with these girls and these five white girls, and they could basically do whatever they wanted to do. I mean, we'd go over to their house and their brothers would, you know, be drinking and smoking weed. And one day we're over at Rebecca's house and we're down in the basement, and Rebecca's mother comes and to the top of the stairs, and she looks at us and she just goes, "Family meeting." And everybody rose up like a choir and went upstairs. So I went upstairs with him. I'd never seen anything like it. So I go up to the family meeting and I'm sitting there and Rebecca's mother goes, "Rebecca." That's my white woman voice. "Rebecca." She said, "Rebecca, your father and I have been communicating. We understand that there's been some alcohol consumption. And Rebecca, your father and I have discussed it, and we feel that if you're going to drink, we would appreciate it that you do it at home." I said, "What'd your mother just say?" She said, "Yeah, she wants us to drink at home. It's safer." I thought that was the closest family I ever met in my life. I remember I went home and asked my mother, "Can I have a beer?" She was like, "Uh-uh." Just different. And I started hanging out with these girls. And at the age of 13, my friend Rebecca came over to my house and she had a brown bag with two bottles in it. And it was Boone's Farm apple wine. You know what? I talk at my church on a regular basis, right? When I tell them that I drank Boone's Farm, they don't have that reaction. But you come to a function of Alcoholics Anonymous and you mention Boone's Farm and people come alive. They just come alive at the thought of drinking something that a grape has never been near. We revel in its beauty. Boone's Farm. Apple wine. So Rebecca said that her brothers had schooled her in the art of chugging, and we twisted off the cap, and I turned that bottle up, and I drank as hard and as long as I could. And I don't know what happened to Rebecca, but I can tell you what happened to me. Some people say they don't remember their first drink. I remember mine. And I'm going to tell you something. That whatever it was hit the bottom of my feet, and it rose slowly through my entire body. And as this whatever it is went through my body, things were going on in my mind. I began to think, I don't really have red hair. Freckles started flying off my face. See, I know that this did not happen to Rebecca, her first drink. But that's the difference between me and Rebecca. Because alcohol transformed me that day. And I made a conscious decision that that was something I was going to do every opportunity I got. By the time it got to the top of my head, I was sold. I was sold. It's just like it talks about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I took the drink and the drink took me. Alcohol became my master from day one. I knew it. And I began to drink, ladies. I drank every opportunity I get. And I don't mean any disrespect. You're going to hear a little drugs in my story. Don't panic. Just, you know, breathe and just blow it out slowly. So I smoked a little marijuana. I didn't really like it because it seemed like I smoked it and then ate everything in everybody's freezer that had been there for 10 years. I did a little hallucinogens and it got me a mental health diagnosis. But I have to tell you this story right here. One day I'm with my friends and my friend Rebecca passes me a couple of little pills. She told me to take one. She told me to take two. And told me to take one. I took two. It was strawberry mescaline. Oh, for God's sake, get a sponsor. And so I take these two little pills and we riding around and, you know, we chilling. And my friends decided they wanted to go to McDonald's. And we start headed towards McDonald's. And something happened, ladies, that today I know is called a trip. And I'm riding, I'm driving. They're in the back seat, and all of a sudden, this car shifted down. And things got pretty, I mean, things got pretty. I mean, the McDonald's arch was so bright, man. I remember grabbing my sunglasses going, damn! And we pulled into the drive-thru and we pulled up to this little yellow box. See, they didn't have the digital thing then. They just had the little yellow box. And by this time, I'm in full trip mode. So I get up to the little yellow box, had little holes in it. All of a sudden, I hear some little dude going, what do you want? What do you want? So I'm looking at this little yellow box because I'm appalled that somebody that small would hang out in a container like that just to ask people what the hell they want. So he continues to ask me, what do you want? And I looked at that box with every bit of anger I had in me. I said, no, buddy, what do you and your little buddies want with me? And so I'm arguing with the little guy. Now, I'm not a good fighter, but what I recognized was that I could probably beat him up because he was only about this big. So we pull to the next window after they order out of the back. We pull to the next window. We get up there. Some girl with big eyelashes is just asking me questions. And we pull to the next window and somebody's pushing bags at me. And I'm pushing bags back at him. You know what I mean? And they call the police, rightfully so. So the police show up. He's going to walk up to the window of my car sounding like this. What seems to be? I said, officer, why don't you go ahead and slap them cuffs on me? Because I can tell where this is going. And I went down to the Springdale police station. And they called my parents. They said, we got your daughter down here. My mother said, well, make sure she's warm. Because I didn't have enabling parents. And that started my dance, ladies, with alcohol and the justice system. A dance that lasted me all the way up to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm hanging out and I'm drinking alcohol every chance I get. And I don't know, if you're an artist like me, you know that one day, somebody's just going to discover you. I lived that in my head for years, that somebody is going to discover my gift. And my dad got me a job at a recording studio, so I'm in the bathroom singing. You know how the acoustics are in the bathroom. They're good. And I'm in there, I hit my best Whitney Houston note. And I step out of the bathroom. And there's a gentleman standing there. He said, was that you singing? I said, yeah, as a matter of fact, that was me singing. He said, I can make you famous. Really? He said, but you got to come to Las Vegas with me. No problem. So I went home and I called a family meeting. It didn't quite go like Rebecca's did. I had to, you know, go pick them up, you know. Wait for them to get there. And they get there and my family sits down and I told them, I'll be back for you all. As soon as I get my first Grammy, I'm coming back and we will no longer have to live in poverty. My mother said, we don't live in poverty. My father kept things real simple. He would just look at me and go, something is wrong with you. So I got my mother telling me, Angela, I don't think this is a good idea. My little sister saying, Angie, please don't go. But I had to go, see, because somebody just shared some information with me. Somebody just shared with me that they could do for me what I couldn't do for myself. I'm going. And I went to Las Vegas with this man, and I was a young girl in Las Vegas, Nevada, opening up for some of the biggest stars and having the time of my life. I had arrived. Alcohol is flowing freely. I'm singing, now appearing me. alcohol's flowing freely. I'm drinking, and I don't even know I have alcoholism. But that would be the start of my tumbling down to the bottom. I'm waking up next to people. I know it don't happen to y'all. I'm waking up next to people where we wake up and look at each other, and both of us look at each other and just go, damn! And he's got one tooth, and it's gold. And he's telling me that I told him I loved him last night. And his name was Zeb. So I'm hanging out with this gentleman. I'm singing. I'm drinking. I'm on stage. And I'm beginning to black out. People are telling me. People are trying to help me. They tried to help me along my journey. People would say things to me like, Angie, why don't you just have two drinks? Why don't you not drink whiskey? Just drink beer. It wasn't until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that I heard that the first drink was the problem. Never heard it before. I remember sitting at a meeting and an old timer saying, you know, if you don't drink, you won't get drunk. I was like, what? Is that it? Is that it? This is the solution. This is it. If I don't drink, I won't get drunk. That was brilliant to me. So I'm out here with this guy. He's got his own little afflictions. He's shooting dope intravenously, heroin. I'm drinking on a regular basis, spiraling down, blacking out, and getting blacklisted out of casinos left and right. And before it was all over, ladies, I couldn't get a job in Las Vegas. He became abusive, and he began to beat me like it was nothing. By this time, we're living in a seedy hotel, and he comes and gets me and tells me that he needs me to drive him to the store. And I go down and I get in that car and we drive to that store and he goes into the store and he robs it and shoots and kills the owner. He comes back out to the car with all this blood on him and he told me to go and that's what I did. That's what I did. And 17 blocks, the police surrounded us. So here I am, just a little girl from South Carolina, that innocently takes a drink of alcohol with her friend Rebecca. And years later, I'm sitting on trial in Las Vegas, Nevada on a murder charge, on a robbery charge. And I'm sitting in this courtroom and I'm listening to these people tell me how I've taken somebody's life. What kind of person I am. But I'm gonna tell you something. I sat there and those people could have talked about me like a dog, but they would never beat me up the way I was beating myself up. That's what I love about Alcoholics Anonymous when we come in here. We don't beat people up. This gentleman is still in the penitentiary to this day, and here I am in Orlando, Florida, at the International Women's Convention. I come back to Cincinnati. I get a floater out of the state of Nevada from the governor. And what that said was, don't you bring your ass back to Nevada ever again. No problem. Bye-bye. So I get on that plane and I come back to Cincinnati and I make that solemn resolve. That's it. No more drinking for me. I'm done. And I'm riding back in Cincinnati. You can get on the Sunday bus and ride all over the town. It's called Sunday Pass Riding. And I'm with my brother and sister. We're riding all over the city. And we get downtown Cincinnati to the corner of Liberty and Vine. And there's a restaurant there. And I look over there and there's Cadillacs and Lincolns and pimps and prostitutes. And I remember my little sister looked over there and she said, boy, you can't pay me to go over there. And my brother was like, shoot, me neither. And I was sitting there thinking, I'm going over there tomorrow. So I started riding the number 20 bus downtown Cincinnati on a regular basis, hanging out, drinking, hanging out with the gangsters, sitting and drinking, getting in trouble. I had these three friends, no neck, greasy feet, and tie-dye. I thought these guys were brilliant. They taught me how to go into a department store with a girdle on and roll up clothes, put them in that girdle and walk out of there and then go and sell them to somebody for the remarkably low price of. And they were so close to me, those guys were, until I got arrested. And I go to the Justice Center and I get a physical because I'm in jail and I find out I'm pregnant. I get sentenced to the Ohio Reformatory for Women and I was pregnant. And I'll tell you, the only reason why I didn't lose my mind was because I rubbed my stomach and I told my baby, when we get out of here, I'm going to be a better mother. And I meant that from the bottom of my heart. I meant it. And I carried that baby and I gave birth to my son at the Ohio Reformatory for Women. The warden came to me days before and said, Angie, you're going to have to find a place for your child to go. Because of the amount of time that you're doing, he'll become a ward of the state. And by this time, my family had kicked me to the curb, and I had to call my mother and father and tell them I needed them to come and get my son from prison. And I called my mother, and I said, Mama, I need you to come and get my son. She said, Angela, you got a baby? I said, yes, ma'am. And I need you to come and get him. And they drove up there to get my son, and they didn't stop to see me. They did what they came there to do. And they drove off that farm, and I watched my son leave the Ohio Reformatory for Women through a slit this big. And I remember it like it was yesterday. He had on a little blue snap-up and a little blue hat on. And I remember I said to him, I'm going to get my act together, and I'm going to do the right thing. And when I got my freedom, my son was 4 years old. All the way down that highway, all I could think about was just holding his hand and just holding him in my arms and just telling him how much I loved him. I got to the Greyhound bus station in downtown Cincinnati. If you're new in the room, please read that book. And more about alcoholism. It says, suddenly the thought crossed his mind. And I got to that bus station, and suddenly the thought crossed my mind that surely one drink won't hurt me. And I walked up to that bar with the sole intention of just having one. You see, because I had been locked up, just one. Just one. And it would be years that I would see my son again. I don't struggle with the powerfulness of the disease of alcoholism. I don't struggle with that. As much as I love my kids, I got this thing called alcoholism that's more powerful than the love that I feel for my children. And that as much as I would like to get there, if I take a drink of alcohol, it's a done deal. All bets are off. So I'm hanging out and I'm drinking and I'm hanging out with my friends and I get arrested. And I'm pregnant. I'm pregnant again. They give me probation. And I come out, and I'm ashamed to say it, but it's the truth. It's my story. I knew I was pregnant. And I didn't have one day of prenatal care. I drank every single day. Because I don't know how you think, but how I think, I thought that it would go away. Somehow or the other, it would just go away. And I drank every single day with my daughter. And I don't know about your story, but God has always placed angels in my path, always. And I'm working at this restaurant. I'm trying to hang on, y'all, because in my mind, I'm saying to myself, if I could just save up enough money to get me and my baby an apartment, we'll be okay. We'll be okay. And I'm working. I'm trying. And this white couple says to me, Angie, look, you look like you're having a hard time. We're getting ready to open up a store in Bloomington, Indiana. Why don't you come over and work for us? And I said, okay, because I'm going to give my baby up for adoption. See, I learned from my son. And I said, you know what? I'll just give her to somebody who can take care of her. And we go over to Bloomington, Indiana. And I'm over there with them, and they're trying to help me. But I can't put the alcohol down. I can't put it down. And I go into labor. And this couple is in the room with me. And I'm trying to have this baby. And when you say you're going to give a baby up for adoption, right as you're about to have them, they come in and they throw a tarp over you so that you don't see the baby. And Tom and Elizabeth are standing on either side of me. And they come and they take my baby. And I remember thinking, why can't I take care of my kids? What's wrong with me? Never once thinking about the alcohol. Can I get a Kleenex before I electrocute my damn self up here? Yeah. Where was I at? Huh? Right. So my parents find out that I'm at the University of Indiana Hospital, and they call. And they say, Angie, please don't give our granddaughter away. Y'all come home. We'll handle it. Y'all just come home. And I got on that bus with that newborn. And I remember saying to God on that bus with her in my arm, just don't let her cry. I don't know what to do. Just don't let her cry. And for 4 hours, that baby never made a sound. I had to lift her little body up just to see if she was breathing sometime. And I got to the Greyhound bus station, and my mother and father were there. And we stepped off that bus, and I walked over, and my father kindly took my little girl out of my arms. And he said, we got her. And I said, Daddy, what am I supposed to do? He said, I don't know what you're supposed to do, baby. But she didn't ask for this. And they pulled off in that car with my baby. And I went up to that bar and I drank as if there was no tomorrow. Every time I saw somebody with a child, I just couldn't deal with it. My sobering moments were just too hard. I just drank. By this time, I'm living in a boarding house on the banks of the Ohio River. I leave that boarding house and I go up to the bar to drink. I meet a guy who asked me if I wanted to do some other substances, and I went with him. And we go, and he's shooting dope. And he asked me if I wanted something, and I said, yeah. And he filled up that syringe to what I know today was water and shot it into my veins. And I left out of that house, y'all, and I felt like I was going to die. And I'm walking down the street with a bottle of wine, and I'm just taking a drink, and I'm just saying, God, please, I don't want to die like this. And I'm walking towards that boarding house, and I'm praying to God, and I'm just saying, please, if you just let me get there, if you just let me get there, I can't die on the streets. And I get to that boarding house, and when I get there, there's a little blonde woman standing there. And she looked me in my face. You guys, it seemed like everything in the world stopped. And I heard her clearer than I've ever heard anything. And she looked me in my face and she said, "You do not have to keep living like this." I said, "I'm sick and I need you to help me." And she went up to my room and she put a rag on my head and she began to tell me about her drinking. She didn't tell me how much she drank, but she most certainly shared with me how she felt as a result of her drinking. And I could get with that. She asked me if I'd go somewhere with her. I said, "If it's going to make me feel better, I'll go." And she took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. So we get to this clubhouse thing. It's about 200 Harleys parked out front. All these white people with white cups. Some guys on the porch playing John Denver, "You Fill Up My Senses." And it just seemed like everybody was just swaying like this. Just carrying on conversations, but just swaying. And I remember thinking, wow, this is interesting. So I'm walking up the walk and people are reaching out their hands to me. "How you doing?" "I'm Pepsi Bob, Wino Bill, Big Book Billy, 12 and 12 Tom." And I said, "Well, they got some interesting nicknames." And I get to the top of the steps and this big biker guy grabs me around my waist, lifts me up and says, "Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Squirrel." I said, "Squirrel, you're going to have to put me down, brother." And we walk into this big room and she said, "Some guy's going to tell his story." And I sat down and the people started coming. Boy, they happy. Just everybody so damn happy. Just happy, happy, how you doing? "Hey, how you doing? Keep coming back. Live and let live. Hey, how you doing? 20 days sober? Good for you. Keep coming." I said, "What the hell?" Then they read a whole bunch of stuff. Then they pass the basket. I said, "Oh, here we go. Yeah, I've seen this one before." And then this gentleman gets up and tells his story. I was appalled at what this, I said, "Why is this white man up here telling all his business like this?" And that's what happened. Everybody laughing. I said, and they laughing at him. So this is how I heard it. He said, "Well, you know, I smacked my wife around and beat my kids 12 times today, but I haven't had a drink." Bravo! Bravo! I said, "What the hell kind of organization is this?" So then, after he gets done, everybody bows their head to pray. I said, "And they hypocrites too." So they latched on to each other. They say the Lord's Prayer. They chant. Now the whole time I'm like this because I got to pay attention, but I do want to get a little spirituality. What the hell was this about? So, you know, I'm from the street, so I'm like, "Hey." You know what I mean? "Hey. Keep coming back. It's something if you're something. Keep coming back." And then one day I figured out what they said. They said, "Keep coming back. It squirts if you jerk it." No, I'm kidding. I'm joking. I'm so joking. Oh my God. I can't even believe I said that. I'm glad my sponsor's not here to hear this sort of language. Could you edit that for me, Mr. Pepper? Take that off of there in case my sponsor gets a hold of it. And so I said, well, I'll keep coming back. And I hung around Alcoholics Anonymous, never really thinking that I was quite like you. I mean, I had some issues with alcohol, but not the big A word. Not alcoholic. That's a bit serious. So I came to meetings. I was the belligerent black girl. Everything was because I was black. Oh, yeah. There could be some cute little white girl going, before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I really didn't like black people, but now I do. Thanks to AA and sponsorship. And I'd be the one in the audience going, well, we ain't going nowhere. Power to the people. Freedom. Freedom. Oh, freedom. And my sponsor would say, would you sit down? Now, she was from England. And I said, oh, okay. And wait a minute, sister, while we're on the subject. You need to be a little nicer to me. You know, with slavery and civil rights and all. And she goes, oh, really? Who do you personally know that's a slave? I said, well, I don't know nobody personally, but she goes, until you do, we won't be having this conversation. I was like, oh, okay, I see why people kill their sponsors. So I hung out around AA and, you know, just chilled. Went to meetings. Everything was because I was black. If I ordered coffee at the coffee bar and you didn't get it to me in enough time, I would say, it's because I'm black, ain't it? That's why I can't get my black coffee. Why I got to drink my black coffee out of a white cup? Why can't I drink it out of a black cup? And they would say things like, oh, Angie, you just keep coming back. Of course I will. And I hung out. And I don't mean any disrespect, but about this time, they start coming into AA with this little crack problem. Might not happen in your town. But in our town, they were coming in by droves. And I remember thinking to myself, this is AA. We don't deal with crack here. And they were coming in, and all of them weighed the same thing. I said, how does this happen? Do you guys get together at 60 pounds and go, are you 60 pounds? How about you? You 60 pounds? Let's go to AA. So they're all sitting back at the round table with their eyes extremely big. And I walked back to the table. I said, listen, is there any way that either one of you could blink anytime soon? That would be really odd. If you could just blink, blink. So they start telling me about crack. And I told them, well, look, you know, you can come here. Don't say anything. But you can come here. And maybe they'll come up with a Crackaholics Anonymous. But this is AA and we deal with alcohol here. And I'm telling you this to tell you this. I judge those people. Every time they came into the room of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can stay here. Don't talk. And one day I was sitting at a meeting, wasn't a cloud on the horizon. And suddenly the thought crossed my mind. See, because I had heard you talking about God using you as an instrument. I said, you know what? I think God is using me as an instrument too. And I think he wants me to go and find some black people and bring them into AA. So I'm sitting at the Wednesday night meeting. Old timer said, is there any AA announcements? I said, oh, look here, people. I hope that you all know that alcohol is bad for you. I'm going to roll on up out of here. Thank you for the real thick book, and y'all keep coming back and Live and Let Live and all that other stuff. And I took my big book and I walked out, never once thinking that I personally was headed for a drink. And I walked out of there, and I went down to the end of the sidewalk, and I said, I don't know what bus I'm going to get on. I got on that bus. If you didn't like what I had to say, you shouldn't have asked me to come here, Ann. No, I'm just kidding. Listen, they need Kathy A. If you're in the room, could you go over here to right there where she is? Is it a Kathy A in here? Thank you. There she is. There you go. Hey, Kathy, this is my time, honey. Just want you to know that. Where was I at? So I leave, and I go walk down the sidewalk, and I get on the number 43 bus headed downtown. And I say, the first black person I see that's drunk, I will carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got on that bus, and a brother got on, and he was extremely intoxicated. And I slid over next to him on the bus, and I said, brother, have you been drinking? He said, yeah, I had a little something. I said, you know, you might be an alcoholic. So he started cussing me out on the bus, and, you know, I had my big book, and I said, you know, brother, you know, the people from the AA club told me that you would probably react like this to my information. So I'm going to share a little information with you that, in a way that you can receive it, and I know how to give it. And I opened up the big book to chapter 5, and I told you that I'm from a family of Baptist ministers. And I stood up in the aisle of that bus, and I said, rarely! Did you hear what I said? I said, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. I said, those who do not recover are those who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. And the bus driver said, oh, hell no. Bus driver said, you got to get off this bus. And I told him he, too, was an alcoholic. And I went on downtown Cincinnati to the Red Horse Bar, where I knew it was some black alcoholics. And I walked in there, and they were all in the back of the bar dancing on the dance floor. But I knew they were in pain because I had been to AA. And you guys had taught me about the masks that we all wear. And I went back there and snatched the plug out the jukebox and told them, I said, black alcoholics, they got a place for you. It's called the AA Club. You two never have to drink again. They said, what you doing down here? I said, I graduated. And so I'm in there carrying the message of AA, and suddenly the thought crossed my mind that surely I could have just one. I ain't had one in a while. And I took that drink from that bartender, and 45 minutes later, I was in a crack house. I ain't thought about smoking crack. Why, that was for them. But this is what I learned from that situation, ladies, that any time I stand in judgment of one of God's children, that I just wrote that meal ticket to experience it on some level in my own life. I'm an alcoholic, and I know I'm an alcoholic. I don't struggle with that at all. But that crack had me gone, y'all. I came back June the 20th, 1991, and I was part of the 60-pound club. My hair was matted to my head. I hadn't had a bath in I don't know how long. Everybody in my family had kicked me to the curb. And all I knew was to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm so thankful for the members of Alcoholics Anonymous when I came back that they welcomed me. Some of them talked about me, but the members helped me. There's a difference. And I was properly horrified and thoroughly convinced, y'all, that I got to do something. And I walked into that bar, and that old timer, that same old timer that was at that meeting that night, looked at me and he said, "Angie, you're going to die." And I said, "I know, and I need you to help me." And he reached up on that shelf and he gave me the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he told me to go to the front door of that clubhouse, and everybody that came in, I needed to introduce myself and say that I was an alcoholic. And I stood there as dirty and nasty as I was, reaching out my hand. And people would be carrying on a conversation, but they would turn around and look at me and they would pull their hand back. We got to make sure we don't get too good in AA. That those people that may not look like they want it. It says the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. It didn't say shit about what I look like. I'm real thankful for the women that when I came in, I'm the wrong one to talk to if you feel like you can't get sober without a place to live, because I didn't have anywhere to go. I stayed at that clubhouse until they turned the lights out. And then some member of AA would say, "Where are you going tonight, Angie?" And I would say, "I don't have nowhere to go." And they say, "Come on. You can sleep on our couch." And I get up and I come back the next day. And they would let me use their laundry. See, all I had was the clothes on my back, so I had to keep wearing that stuff over and over again. But I stayed in that clubhouse because, like I said, I had been properly horrified and thoroughly convinced that when I put alcohol in my system, what happens to me don't happen to my brother. My brother takes a drink of alcohol, he goes to work. I take a drink of alcohol and I'm on the evening news. That's the difference between me and my brother's drinking. And I stayed in AA. I couldn't call home. I couldn't see my kids. I couldn't do anything. I used to sit around the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and thank God for the old timers, because I would sit around the room crying about, "I want to see my kids. I want to see my kids." An old timer said to me, "Angie, buy me a cup of coffee." I said, "I don't have no money." He said, "That's why you don't have your kids. Get a job." And at 3 years sober, my family asked me to not contact my children anymore. They said, "They're acting out, Angie. Just leave them alone." And I remember I went to all kinds of people at AA. "What should I do?" They said, "Angie, fight for your kids." And I sat down and I talked with my sponsor. And I said, "What should I do?" And she said, "Angie, just leave them alone, honey." And I did that. But if you got kids, you know, I had to see them though. And I would be at my daughter's soccer games, and I'd be way in the corner, but I would have to see my babies. And I would be at my son's basketball games, and I'd be up in the bleachers with a baseball hat on, but I had to see him. I watched my daughter go to prom from across the street in the back seat of my car. And she walked out of that house, man, and she was beautiful. And on my daughter's 18th birthday, she called me. And she said, "I want to see you. I got some questions I need you to answer." And I went and picked my daughter up and we went to the mall. And we went in there and she spent every damn dime I had. I said, "I got to be a little more specific in my prayers. That I got to say, 'Lord, I want to see her, but I'd like to have some change in my pocket when it's all over.'" But I'm going to tell you something. I rode back home with that 18-year-old girl in my car. And I told her it wasn't a day that went by that I didn't think about you. But I was sick. And she laid her head on my shoulder. And I drove her back home, and that's how she laid. And I rubbed her arm, and I told her that I loved her over and over again. And we got to my mother's house, and she said, Angie, you know I don't want to cause no confusion. I said, I got to clean off my side of the street. I'm cool. You just be okay. And that was it. And you know what? I was okay with that. Because if I got what I deserved, I wouldn't have got that. My son is now 26 years old, and he's just been sentenced to more time in the penitentiary than he's been alive. Thank God for the program of Al-Anon. Because as I sat through that trial with my son, for the first time in my recovery, I knew that it wasn't because of me that he was there. He was there because of some choices that he made. Thank God for Al-Anon and AA. So I didn't have a high school education when I got here. Thank God for the big book meetings because they taught me how to read. Thank God for those patient people that taught me how to read. And I took their test and I passed the GED and I left there and I went to the University of Cincinnati, where I got my liberal arts and social sciences and addiction studies. God has been good to me, you guys. I want to tell you about my mother real quick. My mother is mentally ill. And my mother doesn't believe in taking medication. And I'm watching her deteriorate every single day. I'm so thankful for you women, man, that taught me how to be my mother's friend. That taught me how to show up. It's easy to come to meetings and empty ashtrays and set up chairs. Can I practice these principles at home? Thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God. Oh, yeah, my daughter's dating a white guy. Oh, God, help me. She calls me and she said, his name's Jeremy. I said, of course it is. God has been good to me, you guys. God has been so good to me. I absolutely adore Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been able to do things that I only read about in brochures, man. I got a call to speak at the last international. And I went there and I spoke and my life ain't been the same since. Teresa and I were there. And I'll tell you what, my life has took on a whole new meaning. I got to go on a cruise, man. I had the time of my life. Man, I sat there. I would be on that deck, man, and I would be looking across at that water, and I couldn't see nothing but water. And I thought to myself, there's one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. I couldn't believe it, man. I said, I'm on a damn cruise. I'm on a cruise. I was just walking past the help going, I'm on a cruise. I'm a drunk crackhead and I'm on a cruise. I'm on a cruise. And Snow showed me a time that changed my life, man. Changed my life. And it's been a blast, you guys. You know, back home, my grandmother, she used to rock in her rocking chair and she would hum this song. And she would give us little glasses of sassafras tea with a piece of mint in it. And we would sit there in the heat of the summers in South Carolina, and we would sip that tea, and she would hum this song. And I never, ever knew the meaning of it until I stood on that platform at the International.
And I'm going to close with that song.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. See, I was lost, ooh, but now I'm found. I was blind, but now I see. Thank you, ladies.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.